Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, it's April 1st, which puts us well into 2015. How's your to-do list coming along? New Year's resolutions? Feeling a little edgy? Experiencing, perhaps, a gnawing sense of anxiety? A GSA. If you're lucky, you may simply have an anxiety-prone nature. If not so lucky, you may suffer from a clinical anxiety disorder, which affects 40 million American adults and is the most common mental illness in the U.S. Joining us to talk about anxiety and the anxiety toolkit will be Dr. Alice Boys.
Then Dan Rubenstein. Loves to walk, and he thinks you will too. Dan has written a book, Born to Walk, The Power of One Step at a Time. He joins us for a stroll through his experiences and the virtues of slowing down.
This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a proud supporter of KPCW and a not-for-profit community hospital. Park City Medical Center's Live Well Center is a wellness center designed to help you live your healthiest life possible. We use lifestyle medicine with the goal of helping you maintain or improve your health, prevent disease, and manage any existing conditions. Whether you're hoping to lose weight, gain a competitive edge, or simply live a healthier life, the Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment for a lifestyle medicine consultation by calling 435-333-3535.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, don't worry, be happy. For some children who have an anxiety-prone nature, a trait and not a flaw, growing up in a family where they constantly hear this message may leave them feeling like there is something wrong with their natural self, leading to a lack of self-acceptance. For many of the 40 million adults in the U.S. suffering from clinical anxiety disorders, this or similar experiences are common themes. Here to explain anxiety is Dr. Alice Boyce. She's the author of the Anxiety Toolkit. There's strategies for fine-tuning your mind and moving past your stuck points. Dr. Boyce, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hello, thank you very much. My sister has just spent about 6 weeks in Park City and absolutely loved it.
Oh, wonderful. Glad to hear it. Well, let's start with this, Dr. Boyce. I mean, we think about maybe two types of anxiety, you know, clinical anxiety disorders, and then the one that a lot of us have, which would be, we're starting to call the GSA, because someone taught us that term last week, gnawing sense of anxiety. So maybe you could start by distinguishing the two.
Yeah, so usually any disorder is going to be defined by whether it's significantly distressing for the person or it's impairing them in their life. So if it's getting in the way of their work or their relationships or other aspects of their life. So there'll be certain checklists of symptoms that defines whether people have a disorder or not. But there's also generally that criteria that runs across all different kinds of anxiety disorders, where what's really important is how distressing is it for you, which is obviously a subjective thing, and how much is it impacting on your life? Is it something that your spouse is always complaining about, or is it something that's causing you to opt out of certain activities that you would otherwise potentially do?
And how often does it happen that someone is born, as a baby from the get-go with anxiety disorder? Is it always something we learn?
Yeah, so children aren't born with an anxiety disorder, but most people who have anxiety disorders report having had an anxiety-prone nature through their life. Some people turn up with an anxiety disorder and will say that they don't recall having been anxious through their life, but they might have had some trigger that's brought it on. But for a lot of people, myself included, we can remember having been anxious through our lives. So I remember things like the fact that I wouldn't go on school camp and that each year before the new school year started, I was absolutely terrified about a new teacher, that any kind of transition or big change like that, like going from one classroom to another, was a huge thing. I used to get all these physical symptoms and didn't really know what they were.
Dr. Boyce, I'm fascinated by the early development stage that you refer to and how children growing up in an environment that leads them to question their true nature, because true nature is such a critical element. Most children seem to be connected with their true nature until the environment or society or familial experience or societal experience moves them away from their true nature. Are there common triggers and themes that you have identified that contribute to that shift and creating what we would call clinical anxiety disorder?
Yeah, there are obvious traumas. There are things like going in a war and coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder. So it can be triggers to anxiety that are related to stress. There can also be role transitions can be a big trigger. So somebody, for example, that maybe is in a corporate job that moves to being an entrepreneur and has to make a lot more decisions or has to deal with a lot more uncertainty, those kinds of things. Somebody that maybe goes from a small school where they've got a few friends to a huge school. Somebody that goes into a highly competitive college program where they're under a lot of scrutiny, or maybe they're having to sit verbal exams as well as written exams, and they've only done written exams in the past, or somebody that all of a sudden has to do public speaking for their job. Those kinds of things can bring anxiety.
Well, then in your book, do you address, I know that it's a toolkit for managing what has already been identified and what's in place. I mean, here we have people who either have a nature-prone tendency toward anxiety, or they are clinically, in a condition of anxiety disorder, and you have a toolkit with how to deal with various issues and get from stuck to unstuck. But what about dealing with that formative time? Do you make suggestions to families and parents on how to help their children through those difficult transitions?
Yeah, I think in the book, because the book is mainly focused on adults, There are some things that when an anxious person understands their own nature, that they can sort of extrapolate back and think, well, if I got some of these messages as a child to help me understand my nature, that would have been really helpful. So, just as a personal example, I have the world's most wonderful mother, but she's very, very non-anxious. So she would often tell me, not to worry about things and to think positive and those kinds of things. And really, because she wasn't anxious herself, she didn't understand my anxiety at all. So for a parent who's got an anxiety-prone child, to help them understand those physical sensations, to help normalize those butterflies in the tummy, all of those kinds of things, help normalize that the child may feel physically sick when they have something like maybe like a sports event at school and they start getting diarrhea or something like that, helping them understand that that's all part of the body's natural anxiety reaction. And there's some fun things you can teach kids, like you can teach kids about the reasons behind the anxiety symptoms. So we have sweating when we're anxious, and the idea is partly it's for cooling off, but there's also a theory that it helps that make us more slippery, so that if we got into a fight, we're harder to Well, we have goosebumps when we are frightened, and that relates back to the idea that when we were animals that had enough hair on our arms, that it would cause our hair to stand on end, and just like with a cat. So, and when you see a cat arch their back, and it makes them look bigger and scarier, the fact that you sometimes get a little bit of tingling sensations in your fingers, feet and fingers, when you're anxious is because the body's moving all the blood through your central areas and away from your extremities. And one of the theories behind that is the idea that if you got into a fight and you're an animal and you got a finger lopped off or something, that there would be less blood in those extremities, so you'd be less likely to bleed out. So kind of teaching a kid about the physiology of it. Of anxiety, if that's something that they're curious about. So, and often anxious kids will really like to understand things. That can all be really, really useful.
Boy, that's really interesting. And those of us who haven't, you know, if we're parents and we've never experienced anxiety, we have no idea about those physiological symptoms. And just telling our kids to get over it and buck up would produce quite the opposite effect, I would imagine. Wanted to ask you, moving into adulthood, because as you say, the anxiety toolkit is mostly focused on adults. Let's talk about just slight, as we were saying before, gnawing sense of anxiety, just slight anxiety, because I would imagine there are people walking around, many more, perhaps millions more than we would think, that are suffering anxiety but haven't yet identified it.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, especially for guys, is irritability. So often if you're finding that you're snapping at, for example, a spouse or maybe at employees or those kinds of things, asking yourself if anxiety might be underlying that irritability, like maybe you're worried about something and therefore anytime someone else mentions it, you get that sort of 0 to 100 in 3 seconds flat trigger. That might manifest itself as snapping at somebody. So, for example, it might be a staff saying, you know, why haven't you done that thing that I've asked you to do? Why haven't you asked your boss yet about those vacation dates I wanted you to check on? And the reason the person might be avoiding asking might have something anxiety-related underlying it. But that ends up being an irritability fueled discussion with a spouse. It looks like irritability, but maybe there's some anxiety that underlying it person's not able to talk about.
Uh-huh. What about things like procrastination and perfectionism? They're tied to anxiety.
Yeah, they definitely are. I mean, so we all know that we procrastinate when we feel overwhelmed by something. And in this day and age, there are just so many demands on us that a lot of us spend a whole lot of our lives feeling overwhelmed by all the things that we have to do. So, well, people end up putting off things that are important, but that they feel really intimidated by. And again, that's something that ends up having a bit of a feedback loop, because especially in marriages where someone is putting off something and that impacts on the other person, like maybe, you know, I guess around this time of year we're thinking about filing taxes. Maybe one of the partners is in the relationship is sort of putting off getting their taxes stuff together because they find it hard, and then it stresses out the other partner, and then you end up with this unit with relationship stress to deal with as well as the original problem.
Dr. Boyce, so on the far end of the spectrum where we have the anxiety disorder, we have these negative implications, but I'm thinking there might be some positives that come from the other end of the spectrum. If you have a anxious, true nature, you could actually use that to motivate yourself and get things done. And there may be, you know, we always hear that you get where you put your energy is very important to manifesting and achieving. So doesn't a small amount of anxiety focus our energy in possibly positive ways to motivate us?
Just like being an extrovert or an introvert, it's not better to be one or the other. It's not better to be someone who's calm by nature. You know, they each have their own different qualities. So sometimes everybody can give examples of when anxiety has caused them to, for example, check something, and then checking that thing has ended up leading to them not missing something that was important not to miss, or sometimes anxiety can lead to conscientiousness. It can, things like worrying about how you're perceived by other people can lead to being conscientious and doing real things that help you be perceived positively by other people, where it could be remembering to give positive feedback, or, you know, giving praise. It could be remembering to look like you're paying attention. So if you can channel anxiety into conscientiousness, that can be really helpful. What's really unhelpful is when you channel it into perfection. perfectionism, and there's a lot of research coming out at the moment showing that perfectionism is something that's really unhealthy. It's a risk factor for a bunch of things. But then on the other hand, conscientiousness is known to be a really protective factor. So you've got that kind of thin dividing line, and if people can figure out that dividing line and stay on the conscientiousness side of it, anxiety can be really helpful.
Well, that's interesting, because I wanted you to share with us kind of the evolutionary origins of anxiety and how anxiety may have helped. And you've touched upon that. It's a hyper-focus and alertness. And as early humans, you had to be pretty darn alert to survive, I would imagine.
Yeah, so the fight-flight-freeze mechanism is our panic mechanism. And that's designed for when a danger is present. So you're walking, enjoying a nice walk through the forest, and you see a bear, and you need to either stay still so it doesn't attack you. You need to either fight it, which in the case of a bear would be a really bad idea, or you need to flee. You need to run as fast as you can. And anxiety is designed to make us scan our environment for danger. So it's designed for when we hear a little rustle of something and we're not sure what it is. And so then we end up looking around for danger. So it puts us on the lookout for danger. It's for when there's not definitely a danger there, but there might be. So it gets switched on in situations of uncertainty. And it's fundamentally, it's a really adaptive thing. What happens sometimes is it gets miscalibrated. And when it's miscalibrated, that's an anxiety disorder. But fundamentally, the mechanism is working as it should. So if you're in a situation where there might be a danger, it would be really bad if you could just easily distract yourself from that danger. So we're wired so that it's not easy to distract ourselves from anxiety. And that's how it's supposed to work. And when it's working at a kind of moderate level, you'll get some false alarms, which are built into the system. So if the system can't be perfect, it's much better that you get some false alarms than you miss a real big danger. So that calibration is set up that way. But obviously for people who have anxiety disorders, things get kind of like way out of balance, and they need to learn some strategies to get things back into balance. But basically, the system is working. It's just working on too much of a hair trigger.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Alice Boyes. She's the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. And Dr. Boyes, I'm wondering, I just have to recount this experience I had over the weekend. I was in a restaurant with my sister, who has an 8-year-old boy, and he got up and went to the bathroom and then disappeared. Well, the end of the story is good because he didn't actually disappear, but I saw the escalation of absolute absence of common sense and logic by everyone there, but especially my sister. And she ended up getting physically ill and, all this stuff, when really her 8-year-old was just in the back of the restaurant in the play area, which she didn't know existed. And I thought, maybe there's a way when you're faced with these worrisome issues that we abandon logic and common sense and composure, and I suppose that sort of thing is listed in your book. What would you tell someone who completely loses, who completely freaks out in this instance, which is understandable in a way?
Yeah. So the fight, flight, freeze mechanism, that Kira mechanism, is really designed for action. It's not designed for thinking. So modern life, the situations that it was designed for don't come up very often. Now, one of the beauties is that you can use slow breathing to take yourself out of that fight, flight, freeze mode. So if you breathe slowly, your heart rate will decrease, and you'll be able to regain your ability to think more clearly. So slow breathing really is one of the few things that's basically guaranteed to work, because it's a physiological thing that if you breathe more slowly, your heart will slow down and you'll regain that ability to think rather than just be in that pure action, fight, flight, freeze mode.
Okay, that's a good one. That's a good one. I noticed in some of your literature talking about all the catch-22s, you call them, of anxiety. Things like, people who are anxious tend to have and expect negative outcomes, so then they do, and so then they're less likely to go see a therapist or things like this. Talk a little bit about some of those catch-22s.
Yeah, so some of I went to the clinical psychologist in New Zealand for a number of years before I sort of switched over to the writing side of things, and it was really sad how long people would wait before they would come in for a problem. Often they'd come in for a problem at the point where their spouse had got had felt like they couldn't help them anymore and had said, you have to go in and see someone, or they'd really got to the point where they felt like life was just falling apart for them. But they might have had the problem for like 10 or 15 years or as long as they could remember. But people who are anxious don't like doing things until they're absolutely certain of what the right path to take is. Mm. And obviously there are lots of different choices. There's a whole Google full of different therapists you could go and see or different things that you could try and do. So people who are anxious will often wait until they feel certain about what it is that they should do, and then they end up waiting a really long time. And the other thing is that anxiety causes people to think about have negative expectations of the results of taking action. So people who are anxious will naturally like read a book of strategies and think, well, these strategies, they sound too simple. How could they possibly work? Or these strategies, they might sound like they could work for somebody else, but they probably won't work for me. Or these strategies, I don't think I'd have time to do them. Or all of those kinds of things that they'll think of reasons why it's not going to work out. So those natural tendencies that are associated with anxiety will really get in the way of people doing what they need to overcome anxiety, which is to try out some strategies, find what works for them personally, and then develop some simple versions of those that they can apply just when they need to in their life when they're facing something anxiety provoking or stressful.
Dr. Boyes, you said something a moment ago that has me thinking about a situation that I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. You said that we have this miscalibration, and I'm thinking about early man's environment and today's environment. You could say that today's environment is more complex and we have more issues that are causing or leading to anxiety disorders. But early man had a lot to be afraid of, let's face it. And so maybe everybody was walking around in a high state of anxiety because they had three options, as you said. They could either run, or they could fight, or they could hide. And, you know, it was more simple, but the environment was extremely dangerous. How would you compare that to today's environment and the options available to deal with the triggers that exist today?
Anxiety is designed as a signaling system. So it wouldn't be all emotions are a signaling system. And emotions wouldn't be a very good signaling system if they got stuck on. So they're designed to come to be temporary, to come on and off. So I don't think it's the case that we would have been walking around feeling anxious all the time. And it's kind of good to have a tribe with a mix with some cognitive diversity. So for humanity to have some people who are really bold, who never think about what could go wrong, and some people who are really cautious and always think about what could go wrong, and then have a bunch of people in the middle of those two extremes, you know, to have sort of like a normal distribution curve where most people are in the middle, but there are a few people at either extreme. But that's how traits tend to shake down for us as a tribe, and that's kind of how anxiety is distributed.
Huh. Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, Dr. Boyds, but I wanted to ask you about, you know, those people who might be sitting there listening to this and thinking, I wonder if I have anxiety. You talk about some of the common habits that underlie anxiety. Give us a few that are, you know, kind of surprising if we may not know we have anxiety, but we do.
Yes, irritability, that is a big thing, is asking yourself whether what's underlying that is anxiety. Avoidance coping is a huge one. So if you make other people do things for you because you don't want to do them yourself, so things like you don't want to call customer service, so you make your staff do it because for some reason that seems really intimidating. So if there's something that you're putting off, ask yourself whether there's some anxiety underlying it that you're not recognizing. Perfectionism can have an anxiety underlying it. Is it so important to you that you score at the top of every single class, or that you are more impressive than your neighbors in some way because you have anxiety about some sort of personal inadequacy underlying that? So all of those things, things to think about. Do you seek information a lot? So if you find that you take a really long time to act, and that you have a lot of dreams and don't pursue them, is that anxiety underlying it? Is it the anxiety where you're waiting till you know the perfect thing, and then you may never get to that point of feeling like you know the perfect thing?
Those are good ones. I would say that a lot of people can read through those and say, well, yeah, I do that sometimes and I do that other times. But an interesting awareness that you've brought to us this morning. And the book is The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. And Dr. Boyes, I'm certain that this, because it is sort of a toolkit, that there are lots of quizzes in here and little things to do and sort of a workbook, an activity book?
Yeah, it's designed so that people, we all personalize our Starbucks order these days. We all personalize what apps we have on our phone. So it's that approach to a book where people can mix and match in any way that they want. They don't have to read from chapter 1 to chapter 11. They can take the quizzes and then see which of the chapters is more relevant to them. They can treat it like a recipe book and kind of dip into it when they feel like trying something new, all of that stuff.
Ah, very nice. All right. Well, Dr. Alice Boyes, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about walking. And it's not as simple as it sounds, but it will allow you to arrive at a different place entirely. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City Branch, longtime supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your lending needs, from basic to complex loans. Our loan decisions are made locally. We have two branches in Heber and Midway and one branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR.
Sunday mornings at 10 on 91.9 FM KPCW. Brought to you in part by Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Being a member of the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Do you feel anxious after that? Here's what I think. Mm. I think we all have a little anxiety laying underneath the surface.
Yeah.
I hope so, because I know I do. And that's why it was really nice in our program this morning to start with anxiety and to finish with walking. And there's a lot of really interesting themes in Dan Rubenstein's book, Born to Walk. It's a nice idea, you know, but it takes so darn long to get anywhere. Well, according to our guest, Dan Rubenstein, that's exactly the point. And as we've been told, we just need to slow down if we want to smell the roses. So why is it that some of us like to move through the world at an up tempo while others discover the virtues of slowing down and walking? Dan has been writing and walking for years, and he now joins us to share his experience that led to his personal conversion and the writing of his book, Born to Walk, The Power of One Step at a Time. Dan, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, Lynn. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Well, it's nice to have you join us. And as you probably heard, we just got done talking about anxiety for the last half hour.
So we're still a little wound up, Dan.
Well, we'll see what we can do to step away from that a little bit.
Oh, very good. So why don't you take us through sort of a history, your own personal history about walking? And you found so many different cultures along the way and walking like I've never really heard of before. So tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, I had always been interested in walking. I've always loved hiking. I used to live in Western Canada near the mountains, and, you know, I'm a fairly outdoorsy person. But I live in the city, and, you know, I'm a white-collar professional, so, you know, I spend a lot of time at a desk in front of a computer. And the job I had a couple years ago as a magazine editor was not the healthiest work environment. It was fairly stressful. And the way I coped with that was by going for long runs at lunch every day, longer and longer as the weeks and months went on. And that led to a knee injury, and I couldn't run for a while. And I, you know, sort of out of necessity began walking more. But as a journalist, when I started to sort of look at this kind of physical transition I was experiencing, I started to research and obsess about walking. And first, some of the physical benefits of the act, and then some of the mental benefits, and then the sort of the further I went down this road, looking at social cohesion and economic and creative possibilities, I began to see walking as a way to address a lot of challenges that we face as individuals and socially. And I decided to leave that job to essentially walk and write about walking and talk to people about walking full time for a couple years to see where this type of activity could take me.
I want to introduce a theme that we have here, I think, in the town we live in, Park City, a ski resort town. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. But we have this addiction to endorphins. And I think that they're not everyone in town, but by and large, you know, we're outdoor recreators and we love to feel the effects of getting your heart rate up to a certain, you know, rate for an extended period of time. So you get that endorphin rush. And I think that's, I wonder how that ties into walking, because I have never felt that from walking before.
Yeah. And you know, I guess I adopted a bit of a literary persona to write this book. You know, I do still run now that I've had a knee operation, and I cycle year round to commute. So I do move quickly at times, and I am a skier as well, cross country, not downhill, but you know, there are hills and you do get that thrill of speed from cross country skiing too. So I certainly understand that desire and that need. But for me, walking is mostly a way to connect with other people, with your surroundings and with yourself. And that's not the thrill of a steep hill or a quick race or playing basketball, something else that I do, but it's a different type of feeling, and it's a very fundamental, basic, natural human feeling, and that's something that we have moved away from, I think, in increasingly urban and technological societies. We've turned our backs on the way we have existed as a species for 99.99% of our time on this planet.
Dan, you living in a city, I wonder if you could, if you have a similar perspective on this to my perspective. We live in, as Lynn said, this town where people are running, biking, cross-country skiing, generally moving at a fairly rapid pace. There are some hikers around, and people love our trails for hiking. But by and large, we're moving at kind of an up-tempo pace here in this town. And people don't walk to get places. Yet in urban environments, it's very common to walk 10 blocks, 15 blocks, 20 blocks to get somewhere as part of your daily routine. And it's just assumed that you are going to do a lot of walking. And I'm wondering if you feel that there's a different effect from urban walking, and I'm sure there is from, you know, nature wilderness walking, but also just you touched on the interaction with people, sort of that social component, and cities are fabulous places to walk.
Yeah, and although cities such as, you know, New York or San Francisco or Portland, Oregon, come to mind as places which are regarded as walking meccas, which have compact cores and that dynamic street life which keeps us entertained as we're going about our pedestrian commutes. By and large, Americans and Canadians and people throughout Western Europe have, even in urban environments, stopped walking as much as we used to. One of the stats that I use in the book, and something that rings true as a father with two young children, is that a generation ago, something like 70-80% of kids walked or cycled to school. And now, despite the rapid urbanization of North America, and that's a North American stat, that number has fallen by more than 100%. So it's something like 20 to 30% of kids walk or cycle to school. So yes, in cities, people tend to use their feet to get around, not nearly as much as we used to. So these social benefits that you can experience, you know, getting to know your neighbor, having a relationship with the shopkeeper, keeping an eye on the kids who live down the street as you're on your way to the bus stop, we're losing those types of basic human interactions. And, you know, when you think about major urban social problems, you know, it's a lot easier to be rude or angry when you don't have that face-to-face contact with somebody every day.
So, Dan, Lynn talked about the endorphins that are released when we do our activities at a more up-tempo pace, and those aren't released during walking unless you encounter something that causes that flight or fight reaction that we just talked about with anxiety.
Bear,
yeah,
right,
the bear. but there may be other sorts of benefits and other things that are released in our bodies. Has your research been able to show an actual, you know, response, a scientific hormonal response to walking, or is it more of an anecdotal benefit that's zen and meditative in nature?
The beauty of this project was that we have a lot of we know that walking makes you, you know, relaxes you, makes you feel better, and you sometimes have good ideas when you're walking, but now there's a lot of research underway, and we're talking about sociologists and psychologists and other cognitive health researchers who are being able to quantify that, yes, walking does have these qualities, and this is a power that we might need to pay attention to and harness. There's studies underway predominantly in the UK right now that look at the ability of walking to alleviate mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression. And, you know, this research is happening on right now, so the final conclusions have not been reached yet, but they're building up basically a case that we'll be able to say that if you invest in walking infrastructure, awareness, encourage people to be out and active in an urban environment, you will cut usage of prescription medication for conditions such as depression. You will cut the need for medical intervention. You will save costs in the public healthcare system. But even beyond kind of those basic health essentials or needs, some of the most fascinating research that I explore in the book looks at the relationship between walking and creativity. And, and these are kind of peer-reviewed control group studies that have people walk, have people walk outside versus walking on a treadmill, have people sitting in a wheelchair and being pushed through a university campus, and people stationary. And they're answering a set of sort of creative reasoning questions. And people who answer the questions while walking or after walking outdoors perform significantly better than people in some of the other groups in the study. They don't know exactly why or how that relationship exists, but the psychologists doing this type of work are basically arguing that walking unleashes some of these creative ideas and creative, innovative, out-of-the-box ideas, is something that we need to deal with some of the challenges socially that we're facing.
Dan, do you have a suspicion as to why that happens, why that creative flow gets released? Could it be the stimulus that you're exposed to as you're moving through the world versus being stationary and letting the stimulus come to you? It seems like there'd be a many-fold increase in stimuli.
That's part of it. One of the best explanations I heard was that we have all of these ideas and thoughts burning around in our head, and we're out walking, we're seeing, hearing, smelling new things. And it's that combination of new stimuli with the ideas in our head that leads to new ideas and new conclusions. And this phenomenon may be rooted in our evolution as a species. You know, when humans became bipedal, when we stood up on two legs and started walking around everywhere, our brains were growing. We were becoming more creative creatures. And the thinking is that, you know, these two qualities, bipedalism and creative thought, developed in conjunction with one another, and that one informed the other. So it may be that, you know, it's often argued that bipedalism is one of the essential defining qualities of humanity. Creativity is another, and they may be intrinsically related to one another.
And if you throw a little anxiety in the mix, you've really got something.
Those are all those troubling thoughts turning through our heads when we're walking. There's environmental psychology looks at the calming effects of a natural environment, and there's a concept known as soft fascination. So when you're out in nature, when you're looking at rapids in a river or the wind through the leaves of in a forest, you're kind of focusing on these things, but not really paying any effortful attention. It's effortless attention, soft fascination. So you're absorbing these things without really thinking about them, and it's the calming effect. It's the stimuli, and it's the fact that you're gaining all of this stuff without really focusing on it that triggers new thoughts and new ideas.
It's interesting. I have an 8-minute commute to work by car, and most people would consider me pretty lucky to have that. I do find, however, that having a longer commute, which I might get if I just walked to work, about a half an hour it would probably take. I've often lamented, you know, there's not that kind of downtime where you're just in your commute, you're by yourself, you're not really thinking about anything. And it's funny that I haven't until now thought, well, maybe I could help my problem out of having a short commute by walking.
But you're too anxious to do that.
Exactly.
I mean, and you're, you know, statistically, you're not the norm. I mean, average commutes in North American cities, at least, tend to be half an hour and upwards one way. And again, research shows that people would be willing to take a big pay cut for a shorter commute. That time sitting in our car every day, stuck in traffic, if you live in a gridlock community, is not healthy. And people know that it's not healthy. They just, you know, the mindset is not there that I'm going to live in a place where I don't have to do this. Although now with the younger generations, with millennials, they have a incredible desire to live in the urban core, and walkability and access to entertainment on foot is one of the draws. And for the first time in a couple generations in the United States, we're seeing rates of car ownership and rates of vehicle miles driven drop among millennials, that we're starting to see the turn away from the cult of the car that's dominated life for half a century.
That's a great thing. Our guest is Dan Rubenstein. He's the author of the book Born to Walk, The Transformative Power of a Pedestrian Act. And Dan, I'm wondering if you would take us along with you on your research that you've done on one of those walks where you observed people, native peoples, or you've done so many of these. Just choose one and tell us about it.
Well, some of the most fascinating experiences for me, probably the time I spent in Philadelphia. Philadelphia has some neighborhoods which are quite rough and dangerous. Murder rates are quite high. Per capita crime rates are very high. One of the solutions has been to deploy more police officers into these high-crime neighborhoods on foot. A police superintendent struggling to figure out how to deal with this crime said, let's do this and let's test it to see if it works. So he hooked up with a criminologist at Temple University, which is located in one of the high-crime districts in North Philly. The researcher's name is Jerry Ratcliffe, who had been a beat cop in London before coming to America and getting into this type of work. And he was able to show statistically that not only do police officers on foot increase perceptions of safety amongst residents in these neighborhoods, but they also do reduce crime if they're kind of targeted at strategic high-crime intersections. The pervading belief had been that people feel good when they see more police officers, but it doesn't actually reduce crime. So when a police department is looking at a budget crunch, they're not going to get officers on foot. They're going to have them patrol larger territories in a car. But even beyond that, the spin-off effects of this type of policing is what I found most fascinating. Police officers, and in Philly, every rookie spends a full year on foot patrol now as a result of this pilot project. Hmm. Police officers see that there are good people in bad parts of town, and that they see the vast majority of residents, even in really rough places, are good people just trying to go about our daily lives. So at the start of their careers, young officers realize that I am here to serve and protect, and these are not bad people. These are good people. And they're coming to these conclusions because they're having casual, you know, sort of front stoop interactions as they walk around. They're not driving and squealing to a stop in the midst of a crime scene in a big car in a very kind of intimidating and aggressive situation. On the flip side of that, people who live in these neighborhoods see that police officers are good people who are here to help and protect us. They're not just showing up in a car and arresting my friends and taking them away. They really want to keep this place safe for my friends and my family. So, I mean, it's a relatively new program. You're starting to see uptake in other cities. New York and Chicago are really sort of reinvesting in foot patrol as well. But I just found it fascinating, and it validated a lot of the theories around social cohesion, that if you do have more people on foot, if you do have more of these kind of sidewalk interactions, what urban planner Jane Jacobs calls the sidewalk ballet, then you are going to move towards a more cohesive society.
Dan, I want to congratulate you for taking that big, slow step out of that job that was unhealthy for you and deciding to walk and write. And I'd love you to explain and share with us kind of that personal process. I would imagine that it was not the easiest big, slow step to take. But now, a couple of years later, looking back and what you've experienced, what you've done, where you've walked, who you've met, and what you've written about, you might have a different perspective than you had when you took that step.
Yeah, I mean, I was a couple of years younger then, for one, so perhaps more impetuous and brash. You know, you have a job, you have stability, you have, you know, financial stability, and just, you know, it was a relatively prominent position, so it was a nice place to be as a magazine editor. But I knew it wasn't healthy, and I knew that, you know, a lot of the quick fix solutions we look for just don't exist. I mean, we live in a world where we're geared towards instant gratification. You know, technology and commerce tell us that you can buy or get the answer you need right away, and that'll change everything. When in fact, I think a lot of us know intuitively that it takes a long time and a lot of effort to make a truly fundamental, lasting, positive change. I don't know whether I'm a different person dramatically than I was a couple years ago. You know, I still do get upset and anxious and angry, just like everybody else. And I try to calm down and kind of keep my eyes on the prize and look further down the road.
That's so nice. So for the burgeoning walker out there who might be inspired by hearing this, this is a funny question, but, you know, I was thinking on the way to work, if I were to walk, I'd go up this great bike path that has, you know, a little babbling brook that goes down. And I was thinking about the things that I would see. But what do you tell people to be aware of when they walk, what to look at?
I kind of boiled my quote-unquote manifesto down into three words: walk more anywhere. And as much as I love walking in a beautiful natural environment, and, you know, I live in a city with a couple rivers and a canal, and all are lined with parks and paths, I kind of just say walk anywhere and open yourself up to the possibilities that you will see something or somebody interesting along the way. Some of, you know, my most memorable walks have been in unconventional places, walking through industrial parks in big cities, or walking through kind of quote-unquote boring ex-urban areas on the outskirts of cities, places that you typically don't go on foot. And you see contrast between different types of living. You see how kind of different parts of an urban or ex-urban environment fit together. You see things that you're not really expecting. One of the people and one of the walkers who I interviewed and spent time with, who I find most inspiring, is a guy in New York named Matt Green, who's walking every block of every borough in New York City, sort of a five-year project. And one of the things he says frequently is that, how do you know what you're going to like unless you go see it and experience it? So when Matt walked across the United States before doing his New York City walk, everybody told him, you have to go here, you have to do that, you have to go to Mount Rushmore. And he just said, forget that. Drew a straight line from Rockaway Beach, New York, to Rockaway Beach, Oregon, and said, I'll see what I see along the way. And not only did he meet so many warm and welcoming and inviting people who were very generous and contravened the stereotype of stranger danger, he saw and experienced beautiful things along the way just by opening himself up to those possibilities.
Well, it's a wonderful concept, and we're really glad that you've joined us today. The book is Born to Walk, The Transformative Power of a Pedestrian Act. Dan Rubenstein, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Lynn and Tim. I really appreciate your interest.
All right. Take care. And this is The Mountain Life. We'll be right back.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I want to thank our guest today, Dan Rubenstein, Born to Walk, and also Dr. Alice Boys with the Anxiety Toolkit. I want to thank our underwriters as well.
The doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and Heber Valley Bank.
Okay, Tim, I'm walking to work tomorrow. Mark my words.
I'll believe it when you confirm it.
Okay, very good. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time for news, followed by music with Rudy on the radio.